Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Friday, July 15, 2022, Section A. Gas prices on downward trajectory. By Stuart Doreen. The tables have turned for drivers in Midland. After enjoying gas prices that were less than the state average for weeks during the height of the gas price hikes, Midland returned to a very familiar place, paying more than average. Midland drivers are paying $4.18 for a regular unleaded gas this week, according to the AAA. That is more than $4.14 average across the state. The reason for the position Midland drivers find themselves in is simple. Over the past 2 weeks, the average price of gas in Midland has fallen by 20 cents. The state average dropped by 35. So Midland drivers went from paying 11 cents less than the state average to paying 4 cents more. Midland also went from being the 13th cheapest average to 20th. The statewide price average for a gallon of regular unleaded has dropped 56 cents since the record high set in June. Regional fuel supply levels have increased and crude oil prices have dipped recently due to the concerns of a possible economic slowdown. Mountain Bike Park gets rave reviews. The reviews for the Mountain Bike Park of Midland's southeast side are really positive so far. That's what Stephen Mitchell, Permian Basin Bicycle Association, told the Reporter Telegram. Midland Trail Park is being used and PBBA memberships are up. Memberships are required to ride at the park located at Interstate 20 and County Road 307 near the Harris Field Fire Training Facility. Mitchell said there were 350 people at the park's grand opening in late April, and those people and others who have used the park have experienced two 3.8-mile trails, one described as intermediate and the other easy. A third 3-mile perimeter trail should be ready in the fall. It will be geared toward the gravel riding, although it will also be good for running and mountain biking. The park's trails are not as technical as the mountain bike course in Odessa, but caters to families looking for a place to ride or hikers and trail runners. 80% of the people who come out are mountain bikers. There's also a skills park, 2 to 3 acres of wooden features to help hone riding skills, and park officials are also putting in a jump line. A pump track is also likely in the works. The Midland Trail Park forecasts a disc golf course and a pavilion with picnic tables. The pavilion has been ordered and should be constructed within 5 weeks. Midland Trail Park, as it stands now, has already come a long way since officials first visited with Midland City Council members. The city wanted to do something with the 135 acres with its tall elm trees, deep grass, big mesquite trees, a lake, and a natural topography, but didn't want to manage it. That's where the PBBA came in. Around $130,000 was raised for the project, and we hired a professional trail builder. The trails contain nearly 200 berms that were made using a mini excavator. We ended up with a 3.7-mile intermediate trail, the Blue Trail, and a 3.8-mile beginner trail, the green one. The Blue Trail has a lot more character as it follows much of the tree line, skirts around the edges of the lake, and incorporates most of the natural topography on the property. It does require some basic mountain bike skills to navigate. Maintenance moving forward requires cutting vegetation and clearing the 8 to 10 miles of paths. That's a lot of mowing and cutting mesquite, Mitchell said. Those riding are required to have a membership to or bypasses at the PBBA website. Costs are $5 for 1 day, $30 for a calendar year, and $35 for a family. Renewals take place January 1st, and those using the park will need to fill out a waiver as well. Memberships also to allow riders to use the park in Odessa. QR codes are present at the park that allow easy access for those wanting to sign up and ride. The park is located in southeast Midland near the intersection of I-20 and County Road 307, the Greenwood Highway. Entrants use the driveway north of FN 307 to access the parking lot. The entrance and road are located adjacent to the west side of Harris Field Fire Training Center. There's a small sign at the entrance. Be careful as cars and trucks are moving fast on that stretch of highway. Things to know. The trails are designated multi-use. This makes them inclusive to hiking, trail running, and cycling. No motorized vehicles are permitted except Class 1 e-bikes. All cyclists must wear a helmet. Children under 14 must be accompanied by an adult. Park hours are sunrise to sunset. Access to the park requires membership in the Permian Basin Bicycle Association. Anyone can become a member, and memberships can be immediately acquired at pbbatx.com. Access the park and trails at your own risk. Trail conditions may vary and hazardous conditions may exist. Be sure to use caution and do not ride beyond your ability. Be cautious of snakes, bees, spiders, and wild animals. Carry plenty of water. You will need to open and close the gate to the road until we complete a permanent entrance to the parking area. The gate looks locked, but it only requires removing the chains and swinging the gate open. Those wanting to donate to this project can make a tax-deductible contribution through the West Texas Trail Alliance website at fundtxtrails.org. Rollover kills man in Howard County. A 33-year-old man from Cuero died Tuesday after a vehicle rollover Tuesday afternoon in Howard County. The DPS reported that John Harden was traveling west on County Road 48 when he disregarded a stop sign at Farm to Market Road 669 intersection and lost control of the vehicle. The vehicle traveled off the roadway and rolled over. The driver was transported to University Medical Center in Lubbock, where he died of his injuries. Harden, the lone passenger in the vehicle, was not wearing a seatbelt. Woman dies after crash in South Midland. A 67-year-old woman died after a collision on Big Spring on Wednesday morning. MPD reported that Wanda Kendrick was driving a 2020 Chevrolet Spark westbound in the 300 block of West New Jersey around 10:40 p.m. It was then that she failed to stop at the stop sign at the intersection of West New Jersey and South Big Spring and entered the intersection. The vehicle then collided with a red 2015 Sierra pickup traveling northbound in the 1100 block. MPD reported that Kendrick's Chevrolet Spark then veered to the north and collided with a small tree. Kendrick was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital by EMS with life-threatening injuries and later passed away. Next of kin has been notified. Paul Carroll passed away on June 30th. A memorial service will be hosted by the Triumph Church Beaumont campus in Beaumont. The service will be at 10:30 a.m., Ralph Randy Kennedy passed away on July 10th. A memorial service will be held at Schaefer Nichols Chapel in Crane on Saturday, July 16th at 2 p.m. Rick Mooney passed away on July the 11th. A celebration of life will be held on Sunday, July 17th at 1 p.m. at the Studio on Main in La Mesa. A memorial service will be held in Sheffield on July 18th at 1 p.m. at Mother Homes Baptist Church in Sheffield. Condolences may be sent to the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. Andres Sanaga Cardoza of Odessa died July the 11th. Funeral will be held July 19th at 10 a.m. at First United Pentecostal Church in Odessa. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Funeral Home. Don Mackey passed away on July the 11th. The family will receive guests from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, July 17th at Nellie Pickleham Welsh Funeral Home. Celebration of Life will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, July 18th at Stonegate Fellowship. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickleham Welsh Funeral Home.
This is Reed, and this is the Odessa American for Friday, July 15th, 2022. Oil futures discouraging. Hedges fade with inflation, recessionary fears. Confidence has always been the biggest factor in capitalism, and it's no less so in today's energy industry. With the price of oil bouncing like a basketball in the NBA, and fears of a national and international recession rampant, the futures market is understandably cautious in the extreme. And with the price of West Texas Intermediate crude oil standing at $96.98 per barrel Wednesday, down from $102.24 June 30th, investors don't have the traditional fallback as futures contracts descend from $90.13 in November to $88.27 in December, $84.97 in January, $82.80 in March, and $79.63 in August 2023. Amarillo economist Carr Ingham and Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners President Ed Longenecker say that, as ever, there's nothing simple about the situation. Quote, "It's partly wrought by bad federal energy policy and excessive regulations," end quote, said Ingham, petroleum economist for the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers. Quote, "The futures market may be contemplating a recession, which would clobber demand. Is it justified? Yes, I don't say we're going to be in a recession in the coming months, but we might see some relative weakness in the price," end quote. Ingham said the Biden administration's overspending is another cause. Quote, "We should be continuing to experience a robust post-COVID economy, but inflation is keeping us in check," end quote, he said. Quote, "We've had extraordinary levels of government spending with Biden's massive reconciliation bill, trillions upon trillions. Now they're trying to put together another reconciliation bill." Quote, "With inflation at its peak, the last thing we should want to do is throw more gasoline on that fire," end quote. Ingham was asked if the American energy industry has been affected by the Federal Reserve Board's 0.75-point interest rate increase in June, and its promised key short-term bumps to 3.4% by year-end and 3.8% by December 2023. Quote, "Yes, the Fed is trying to walk a tightrope with a managed slowdown in economic activity that to a degree will bring a contraction in energy demand," end quote, he said. Longenecker said from Austin that China also figures in. Quote, "Recessionary fears and the potential impact of China's draconian COVID policies continue to be offset by concerns over tight oil supplies, and we are seeing these issues impact WTI futures," end quote, he said. Quote, "Regardless, demand will continue to outpace global supply this year, even with the easing of production quotas from OPEC-plus members, many of whom simply cannot increase capacity in the short term. We'll experience increasing levels of volatility in the months ahead due to these and other factors, including geopolitical conflicts and growing unrest over the escalating energy crisis in Europe," end quote. Longenecker also cited the federal regulatory factor. Quote, "A hostile regulatory environment for domestic oil and natural gas production is contributing to uncertainty in the market," end quote, he said. Quote, "That could drive inflation and the cost of goods and services higher for American consumers, even with the economic dampening rate-setting efforts by the Federal Reserve Board. U.S. policymakers are placing undue demands on energy producers. If we want price stability, and if we want to ensure a secure domestic energy supply to address our own energy needs and those of our allies abroad, we need a stable regulatory environment in the U.S. The Biden administration must develop a rational energy policy strategy, including opening federal leasing, approving permitting for energy infrastructure, and providing the regulatory certainty needed to support the long-term investments that are necessary to achieve energy security for our country and allies," end quote. Andrews Ban bus crash still under investigation. The National Transportation Safety Board issued a report on the multi-vehicle crash that killed 3 and injured 37. The crash occurred at 4:01 p.m. November 19, 2021, in the eastbound lanes of Interstate 20 near Big Spring. A 2016 Ford F-350 pickup truck traveling the wrong way, westbound, in the eastbound lanes near mile marker 179, struck a 2005 MCI motor coach nearly head-on. The Ford was occupied only by its driver. The motor coach was occupied by the driver, two adults, and 37 high school students. The 2005 MCI motor coach was the lead vehicle in a caravan of three buses owned and operated by the Andrews Independent School District and had been traveling to a high school football game in a neighboring town. As a result of the collision, the 59-year-old driver of the Ford died, the 69-year-old motor coach driver, and an adult occupant died. One adult and 36 students sustained injuries, and one student was not injured. After the initial impact, the Ford was pushed backward and sideswiped a 2018 Freightliner bus, the second bus in the caravan, which sustained minor damage. No bus occupants were injured, the NTSB report said. The third motor coach in their caravan was not involved in the crash. After the collision, the 2005 MCI motor coach traveled into the median and struck the cable barrier before coming to rest. The 2016 Ford came to rest in the right lane of eastbound Interstate 20 and was destroyed in a post-crash fire, the report said. At the crash location, Interstate 20 consisted of two travel lanes in each direction, which were separated by a median and a cable barrier. The posted speed limit was 75 miles per hour. Conditions, road and weather, were dry, the report detailed. All aspects of the crash remain under investigation while the National Transportation Safety Board determines the probable cause, with the intent of issuing safety recommendations to prevent similar events in the future. The NTSB is working alongside the Texas Department of Public Safety, which is conducting a separate, parallel crash investigation. The Texas Department of Transportation is also a party to the investigation. Any updates to the accident information will be added as the investigation continues. An NTSB investigation typically takes about 12 to 14 months to complete, a spokesman said in an email. Working towards goals. Camp gets students prepared for auditions. Just over 30 high school students are preparing for auditions with the ultimate goal of making all-state choir during University of Texas Permian Basin's large school choir camp. The camp runs through today at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Frank I. Channer, associate professor in the music department at UTPB, said participants were from Odessa, Permian, Legacy, and Midland high schools. Cameron Lopez, 16, will be a junior at OHS. Connor Day Armand, 16, is going into 11th grade at Permian. Zero Dusrepin, 17, is going into his senior year at Midland High School. And Sydney James, 16, is going into 11th grade at PHS. They have all been enjoying the camp, which started Wednesday. Quote, I think it's amazing, end quote, Lopez said Thursday. Quote, everybody's making friends over here. We are learning each other, how you learn the voice parts, how the teachers are helping us with our music. It's been really amazing for the past one day, end quote. Lopez attended the camp last year, but it was very different because of COVID. Quote, last year we had to wear masks, we had to check our temperatures 24/7, and then we had to stay away from each other. But this year it's like coming together again, end quote, she added. Lopez said the camp will help with auditions. Quote, I believe this will help me and help us know where our music is ahead of time so we can practice, end quote, Lopez added. Day Armand said the camp has been great so far. This is his first year. Quote, it's great to be with other people that are passionate about the same thing. It's also great to meet new people that have the same interest as myself, end quote, he added. Day Armand agreed that knowing the music beforehand and singing it really helps, but also knowing how to feel it. The thought crossed his mind that he should have attended the camp previously. Quote, it's a great experience to meet new people who, like I said, have the same interest in myself. End quote, Day Armand said. Dusrepin said he had not been to the large school choir camp before either. He said the fact that he is enjoying choir more than band recently prompted him to attend. He is also in band and plays the trumpet, something he has done since seventh grade. Last year was his first in choir, and this will be his second. Dusrepin said he is still learning about choir. Quote, I thought of it, the camp, as being a greater opportunity than band, because with band, there's lots of tests and challenges. But with choir, it seems like it's more demanding and more put to the side, even though it should be one of the top-tier things that all kids should try out, end quote, Dusrepin said. He said the camp will help him with band and choir, as it will help him learn how to control his breathing a lot more. James attended the choir camp last year. Quote, it's a lot more like a family. We're not so separated. We get to be closer to each other and actually bond and get to know the music together. I feel like having people to learn music with you helps you really focus, having like a support system, end quote, James said. She added that she thinks the camp will help her with upcoming auditions and that it helped her last year. Quote, it helped me learn my breathing and different ways to actually work in music, end quote, James said. I. Chenner said the camp has still not recovered to pre-COVID levels. Quote, before COVID happened, we would routinely run between 70 and 90 in our large school camp. Last year, we were about 45. This year, we were at 33. It's not recovered. We are not back to where we need to be, end quote, I. Chenner said. But having the camp is still worth it. Quote, the students are prepared through this process to audition to be a member of the region choir and then have the option to go on to audition for the pre-area, then all state. Historically, our region has been 80% of the kids in the choir have been people that came to this camp. So it really does work, and it helps our students to be successful. The same thing is true for students at advance. The ones who have put in more time on the music by coming to these camps and working with these great faculty are much more likely to be successful going on to Allstate, end quote, he said. I. Chenner noted that the music is very difficult. Quote, we have 3-day camps for the large school camp and then a 2-day camp for the small school camp because there's simply less music. The small schools, the camp will be Monday and Tuesday of next week, end quote, he added. Quote, most of our folks historically have come from Monahans and Andrews. A large group has come down from Brownwood the last few years, and then a smattering of kids from Seminole, from Stanton, and from some of our other smaller schools out there. We had a few from Kermit, Fort Stockton, end quote, I. Chenner said. He said they are working on a way to have students from farther off stay locally for the camp. Quote, we've had some students come up from El Paso in the past. We've arranged for them to stay at a local hotel, which works out really well, end quote, I. Chenner said. The camp staff is made up of music and choir teachers from area schools such as Midland High and Permian. Quote, we're really proud of those folks. They do really great work and consistently help their kids achieve sweepstakes at UIL contest in the spring. Really exceptional educators, end quote, I. Chenner said. Quote, we also have 8 of our own UTPB students that are preparing to be music teachers that are serving as section leaders. They're modeling group vocal production, rehearsal etiquette, and also serving as team leaders for the activities that we do when we're not singing throughout the day, end quote, he added. There are several ways to keep from losing your voice when you sing all day. Quote, the first thing is you use really great technique. When you came into our warm-up this morning, I was reminding and reaffirming and modeling and helping the students achieve a vital connected sound. Imagine that your voice is like your car. If it's not lubricated and everything is out of alignment, it's going to wear out pretty fast. But if you keep it lubricated, if you give it good gasoline and you treat it well, it's going to serve you a long time. Voice is the same way, end quote, he said. Quote, the other thing that we do is we break up our activities. Generally, we have over the course of the day 4-hour-long or hour and 15-minute-ish rehearsals. Then we break that up with other activities. Games, get-to-know-yous, training on strategies to be successful in the audition process. We simply give the students some vocal breaks throughout the day so that we don't wear them out, end quote, he added. Ector County sees success stopping illegal dumping with high-tech system. The Ector County Environmental Enforcement Unit has seen positive results after deploying flock safety technology to locate and apprehend illegal dumpers, a press release detailed. Flock Safety provides a public safety operating system that helps communities, businesses, and law enforcement work together to fight crime. Last summer, Ector County Commissioner Mike Gardner reported that about $200,000 worth of trash had been illegally disposed of so far that year. The trash included items such as couches, tires, and old appliances, which Ector County was then forced to clean up. The flock safety system helps law enforcement such as Ector County investigate crime by providing objective evidence, license plates, and vehicle characteristics. Most illegal dumping is committed with the aid of a vehicle, making the license plate a critical piece of evidence in locating suspects committing this type of crime. The system also sends real-time alerts to law enforcement when a stolen car, known wanted suspect from a state or national crime database, or missing/endangered person, such as an amber or silver alert, enters the jurisdiction. after County owns all of the data generated by the flock safety technology, and it is never sold or shared with third parties. The cameras cannot capture speed, record faces, and are not intended for minor traffic or parking violations. Quote, while some may think it a minor crime, illegal dumping harms our environment, creates infrastructure issues, and costs Ector County taxpayers hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, end quote. Ector County Environmental Enforcement Director Ricky George stated in the press release. Quote, the county is committed to deploying the latest technology to ensure illegal dumping does not adversely harm the lives of Ector County citizens, end quote. The flock safety system is in use in over 2,000 cities across the country, and the company works with thousands of law enforcement agencies. Law enforcement have reported crime reductions of up to 70% when deploying flock safety in their communities. Ellen Newell Art Museum set to host West Texas Fest. The Ellen Newell Art Museum is scheduled to host the 6th annual West Texas Fest on September 24th in downtown Odessa, near the intersection of Texas Avenue and 4th Street. The VIP sponsor hour begins at 6 p.m., while general admission starts at 7 p.m. The cornhole tournament is set to begin at 7:45 p.m. Patrons must be 21 or older to attend. This event is a fundraiser put on by the Ellen Newell Art Museum to help raise funds necessary to continue its mission in providing quality art exhibitions, educational programs/workshops for all ages, free community art days, and much more for the Permian Basin. West Texas Fest is a Texas beer, wine, and spirits tastings tied along with local food trucks, good music, axe throwing, and a cornhole tournament. Sponsors range from $1,000 to $10,000. Tickets for the event scale from $30 to $60 to $100. Guadalupe resumes camping permits. Effective Thursday, July 14th, Guadalupe Mountains National Park announced that it will resume issuing wilderness use permits for overnight camping in the Guadalupe Mountains wilderness. All remaining precautionary camp, stove use, and smoking restrictions dating to April 14th and April 21st are rescinded. The Dog Canyon developed area, including the Indian Meadow Nature Trail and the Dog Canyon Campground, remain closed due to a water system leak. Hikers accessing areas around Dog Canyon by trail from other sections of the park are cautioned that there is currently no water available at Dog Canyon. As a reminder, day hikers and all permitted overnight backpackers are required to pack out human waste using a landfill-safe commercial toilet bag system. For more information about Guadalupe Mountains National Park, visit www.nps.gov/GUMO. Mistrial declared in murder trial of Odessa man. The fate of an Odessa man accused of stabbing his stepfather to death 3 years ago remains undecided following a four-day trial. A jury of 6 men and 6 women could not reach a unanimous decision Thursday, and a mistrial was declared. Ector County District Attorney Dusty Gallivan said his office will retry Michael Schultz, 40, in the death of Roy Eugene Reeves, 57. He'll remain free on bail until his case is resolved. The jurors began deliberating around 2:45 p.m. Thursday, and at 6:45 p.m. sent out a note asking for instructions because 6 jurors thought Schultz was guilty, 5 thought he should be acquitted, and another juror was undecided. Retired Ector County District Judge Tryon Lewis instructed the jury to continue deliberating, but an hour later the presiding juror told the judge they were hopelessly deadlocked. Raised voices were heard throughout the deliberations. Throughout the trial, Assistant Ector County District Attorneys Ricky Ernest and Scott Turner presented evidence they said proved Schultz, 40, intentionally killed Reeves on October 28, 2019. Defense attorney Scott Turner tried to convince jurors Schultz stabbed Reeves while defending himself and his mother from an abusive alcoholic who had been arrested a month prior on a domestic violence charge. During closing arguments, Ernest told jurors that in order to acquit Schultz, they had to believe Schultz, quote, reasonably believed, end quote, deadly force was, quote, imminently necessary, end quote, because Reeves was trying to murder Schultz and or his mother, Margaret Reeves. However, Ernest said it wasn't until trial that anyone hinted that Reeves was trying to commit murder, and two of the defense witnesses who now claim that who now claim that wasn't present that day. If they watch the body cam videos of the officers present that day, they'll note that although Margaret Reeves and Schultz testified the incident was sparked by Reeves grabbing Margaret Reeves, she never told officers that, Ernest told the jurors. There was no evidence presented during the trial that Reeves was known to carry weapons, was an experienced fighter, or was a huge man, Ernest said. In addition, if Margaret Reeves was able to get away from her estranged husband, as she testified, it stands to reason Schultz could have done the same, she said. If Reeves had actually put hands on Margaret, Schultz would have been justified in beating Reeves or calling police, but that's not what happened, Ernest said. Quote, Roy brought fists to the fight. He brought a knife, end quote, Ernest said, pointing at Schultz. She reminded the jurors Reeves died as a result of 17 stab wounds. During his closing argument, Lay told jurors he stands by his opening statement when he said this was the most clear-cut case of self-defense he's ever seen. Quote, they can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't self-defense or defense of others, end quote, Lay said. Lay accused prosecutors of throwing out ever-evolving conspiracy theories throughout the trial in an effort to create a false persona for his client. They mischaracterized some of the actions taken by his client and his client's mother, despite what can be seen on a neighbor's video surveillance videos and body cam footage, Lay said. Quote, why? Because they can't prove it any other way, end quote, Lay said. Quote, they're trying to manipulate what you're seeing and that shouldn't be done, end quote. They even tried to make it seem, quote, quirky or, quote, weird that Schultz had surveillance cameras in his house when virtually everyone has similar equipment nowadays, he said. Turner tried to make a big deal out of the fact that a family friend wrote about self-defense in an email to Schultz 3 days after the incident. But Schultz had already told officers on the day of the incident it was self-defense and it was caught on body cameras, Lay said. While Margaret Reeves may not have given officers on the scene a blow-by-blow description of what happened that day, she can clearly be heard on their body cams telling them that her estranged husband had threatened her and Schultz and that he'd been torturing them. Had Reeves not been a wife beater, he'd be here today, Lay said. There is no doubt Reeves was living in a, quote, toxic environment, end quote, and his client and Margaret Reeves were scared to death that day, Lay said. Lay asked the jury to remember everything Schultz had heard and seen in the years leading up to that day and to place themselves in his shoes. Just hours before the incident, Reeves had torn surveillance equipment from the outside of Schultz's house, he said. He asked jurors to consider why Reeves might have done so. What was he afraid of being recorded? Quote, you saw her fear the entire time Margaret was on the stand, whether I was asking her questions or Mr. Turner was, end quote, Lay said. Quote, you could see the fear in her eyes when she was describing his eyes. His eyes were so dilated at that point that she could not see the blue in his eyes. She saw pure evil coming at her, end quote. Schultz testified Thursday morning he came to his mother's defense after Reeves grabbed her about the arms. He said he stabbed Reeves repeatedly with a pocket knife after Reeves said he was going to kill him and put him in a headlock. Although a neighbor's camera caught Reeves collapsing to the ground, it did not capture the stabbing itself. During his rebuttal closing argument, Turner told jurors that while Reeves may have been arrested for domestic violence a month before he died, when he died, he was presumed innocent because he was never formally charged and convicted of the crime. He also said the defense failed to provide specific details of any other alleged domestic violence incidents. As for Lay's contention, the state was trying to manipulate them, Turner said, quote, the trial he described is not the trial you just sat through, end quote. Turner said Lay failed to address the testimony of Daniel Sacito, a neighbor of the Reeves, who testified he saw the event from his front living room window. Although Schultz testified many of the stab wounds he inflicted were while he was in a headlock, Sacito never mentioned a headlock. However, he also testified he checked his backyard first when his dog began to bark uncontrollably. Baby's father charges upgraded to capital murder. The father of a dead 7-month-old baby had charges upgraded to capital murder Thursday while the baby's mom has posted bail. Cameron Gamage, 23, who told police Tuesday he has, quote, extreme anger issues, end quote, and admitted he dropped his son while, quote, playing catch, end quote, with him 3 days before the child died. The child's 18-year-old mother, Layla Pearson, posted $5,000 bail, while Gamage remains at the Ector County Jail, having originally been arrested on suspicion of injury to a child. His bail is set at $350,000. Odessa police received a 911 call about a baby who wasn't breathing at 12:52 p.m. Tuesday from the Brady Station Apartments in the 4200 block of East 52nd Street. When they arrived, they found the baby, who would have turned 8 months old on July 23rd, deceased with heavy bruising and swelling to the left side of his face and head, and smaller bruises along the top of his cranium. An Odessa Police Department report details that Pearson told officers she fed her son, Logan, around 5 a.m. Tuesday and woke up around noon to find him not breathing. She said she went to Gamage to wake Gamage up, but he took several minutes to get up, seemed uncaring, and asked her what she wanted him to do. After telling him to call 911, Gamage became apologetic and told her he hoped she wasn't mad at him, Pearson told authorities. Pearson told police Gamage has extreme anger issues and had recently strangled several dogs to death, according to the report. Gamage admitted to having problems with extreme anger and said the baby had been crying a lot and causing him additional stress, according to the report. He also admitted to strangling two dogs recently and disposing of their bodies to avoid getting into trouble. In Gamage's arrest affidavit, police wrote Gamage, quote, remained unemotional and seemed to lack care about the incident throughout contact, end quote. Initially, Gamage told authorities his son had hit his head on a hard portion of the interior of his crib, according to the report. Eventually, however, Gamage told police he and Pearson smoked marijuana on Saturday, and while Pearson was sleeping, Logan began to cry, so he decided to toss him into the air to get him to stop crying. Quote, Cameron claimed he accidentally dropped the infant after the fourth toss, which caused the infant to land on his left side, end quote, the report stated. Quote, Cameron reported the infant hit the floor hard when he landed, end quote. Gamage said he didn't tell Pearson what had happened because he was afraid of getting into trouble. Quote, Cameron reported the infant began acting unusual over the next couple of days. And when he saw the infant deceased this morning, his initial thought was something like he killed his kid, end quote, the report stated. Pearson told authorities that when she asked Gamage about the baby's injuries, he told her Logan had, quote, probably hit his head on a hard part of the crib, end quote, the report stated. She assumed his fussiness over the next few days was due to teething. Online jail records show Gamage is also being held on a sexual assault of a child charge out of Andrews County. According to the Andrews Police Department, they began investigating Gamage in August 2021 for offenses that were alleged to have occurred in 2019 and 2020. When the alleged victim was 15 years of age. He was indicted on May 19th. In an interview Wednesday, Gamage's cousin, Brittany Pruitt, 27, of Andrews, said Gamage is facing a sexual assault count because he became involved with Pearson while she was a minor. Pruitt described Gamage as an outgoing, funny man who loved his son. Up until he lost his job 4 to 6 weeks ago, he worked hard to provide everything he could for him, she said. Dad, not boy, was driver in tragic crash. Report issued in fiery crash that killed 9 people. A report made public Thursday details that it was a Seminole man, not his 13-year-old son, at the wheel when their truck crossed into oncoming traffic and struck a van carrying New Mexico college golfers, killing 9 people, and that the driver had methamphetamines in his system. The March 15th crash devastated the University of the Southwest golf team, killing 6 students and their coach at State Highway 115 and FM 1788 in Andrews County, following a Midland golf event. The group was on the way back to Hobbs, New Mexico, where the university is located. Officials with the National Transportation Safety Board detailed DNA testing results provided by the Texas Department of Public Safety determined the driver of the pickup truck involved in the head-on crash was not the 13-year-old boy, but his 38-year-old father, according to the preliminary report issued Thursday. During an on-scene media briefing on March 17th, the NTSB stated that the driver of the pickup truck was the 13-year-old. In addition to the DNA test results identifying the father as the pickup truck driver, NTSB post-crash toxicological testing revealed methamphetamine in the pickup truck driver's blood, a news release stated. During a virtual briefing Thursday, Robert Molloy, director of the board's Office of Highway Safety, said on behalf of everyone at NTSB, he would like to offer his deepest sympathies to those who were affected by the tragedy. Molloy said toxicological testing of the 38-year-old driver of the pickup truck, Henrik Simons of Seminole, indicated the presence of methamphetamine in his blood. Quote, finally, although preliminary evidence gathered at the scene indicated that a catastrophic tire failure may have occurred, subsequent teardown and detailed examination of the wheel and hub assembly, as well as review of the available roadway evidence, provided no evidence of such a failure, end quote, Molloy said. On how fast the vehicles were going, Molloy said a technical reconstructionist is working on a report, quote, that will help us determine the speed, end quote. Quote, that's something we do like to report when we can in preliminary reports, however. At this time, we haven't determined that yet, end quote, Molloy said. He said tire failure is something that can happen in these types of crashes. Quote, it is something we look at. Again, the catastrophic nature of the crash and the direction where the two vehicles came together, that left front tire that we're talking about, was the one that took the most damage. And so then we had the wheel sent to our NTSB research and engineering lab, and our materials lab within that office did a comprehensive evaluation of that wheel. Based on their evaluation of the wheel, they found no evidence of a catastrophic failure, end quote, Molloy said. Asked if any apology was issued to the family, saying that the 13-year-old was the driver, Molloy said, quote, they were made aware of this report going out this morning, and they can reach out to our family assistance team member with any questions they have, end quote. On whether anyone was thrown from the trunk, Molloy said that is part of the survival factors report that they are documenting and is still to be determined. Whether the occupants were wearing seatbelts at the time of the crash, Molloy said, has also not been determined. Quote, I think something like that crosses over from the factual into analysis, and that is something certainly my survival factors specialist is looking at. But at this time, we're not going to report on that yet. I don't even know if we've completely determined that for everyone yet, end quote, Molloy said. Molloy was asked if there were rumble strips to alert the driver that he was crossing lanes. Quote, my understanding is there was something in the middle of the roadway. The exact type they used warning drivers about crossovers, I can't say at this time, end quote, he said. Molloy said team members are still working on the crash dynamics. He said a final report is likely in mid-2023. Asked if there were any 911 calls prior to the crash, Molloy said that they are still collecting all the information. Quote, and as I said, that information about the methamphetamines being in the driver's blood just came to us. But right now, I'm not in a position to talk about that as the analysis is still going, end quote, Molloy said. The fatal crash included the truck and the university van, which was towing an 8-foot cargo trailer, was driven by the coach, Tyler James, 26, who was in his first year coaching at the school. Both Simons and his son, the unnamed 13-year-old, died. In March, the Texas Department of Public Safety confirmed the identities of all 9 people. The 6 students from the University of the Southwest included 19-year-old Mauricio Sanchez of Mexico, 19-year-old Travis Garcia of Pleasanton, 22-year-old Jackson Zinn of Westminster, Colorado, 21-year-old Carissa Rains of Fort Stockton, 18-year-old Lacey Stone of Nakona, and 18-year-old Tiago Sousa of Portugal. 2 other students who were in the van were seriously injured. Most of the students were freshmen who were getting their first taste of life away from home at the private Christian university, with enrollment numbering in the hundreds. Those who knew James, the coach, said it had been his goal to be a head coach, and he was excited to be there. The crash was the latest tragedy for the Simons family, who lived in Seminole, Texas, a rural community of around 7,500 people, some of whom first relocated to the area in the 1970s with other Mennonite families who started farming and ranching operations. Community members had rallied around Simons and his wife months earlier when a fire that started in the kitchen destroyed the home where they had lived for a decade. School safety top of mind for ECISD. With recent shooting tragedies at campuses in Texas and nationwide, Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray said he wants to remind families of some of the processes that are in place, and also inform families of some adjustments being made for school safety. Quote, we are right now in the process of undergoing a safety audit. Every single campus in ECISD is currently being audited to make sure our safety processes, procedures, and systems are in place, end quote, Murray said. Quote, the initial audit is currently being conducted by the ECISD Police Department. Those officers are visiting every school in ECISD to take care of some basic safety considerations, end quote, he added. The audit is underway now and will be completed by the start of school, Murray said. He added that he wants to remind all families that the district requires students carry either a clear or mesh backpack. Quote, we do not allow backpacks that are not either clear or mesh. So once again, as you are beginning to make those back-to-school purchases, make sure, parents, that you are looking for clear backpacks or backpacks that are made of mesh. Those are the requirements at the elementary, middle, and high school levels, end quote, Murray said. He also wants to remind community members that ECISD has its own police force. Quote, we do not have security guards. We have fully licensed and certified police officers and a chief of police that manages that police force, end quote, Murray said. Quote, you'll find officers stationed every day at our middle schools and high schools, and then officers on patrol every day at our elementary schools. Our officers do a great job of ensuring that our students and staff members remain safe. We have secure access for all of our buildings. All of our campus doors are locked throughout the day. In order to enter any one of our campuses, we require an identification. If you're a staff member, that electronic identification will allow you easy access to our campuses. But if you're not a staff member, whether you're a parent or a visitor, we require that you display your identification, either your driver's license or some other proof of identification, before we allow admittance to our buildings. So once again, that secure access is another way that we keep our kids safe, end quote, Murray said. There are also, quote, several thousand, end quote, security cameras at each school. Quote, those cameras can not only be monitored at the school level, but they can be monitored by our police officers. So once again, those cameras are located on every single campus that we own. We train our staff members and students on what to do in emergency situations. Our students participate on a monthly basis in regular trainings. We ensure that those trainings are done so that all of our kids, pre-K through 12th grade, are well aware of emergency processes and procedures. All of our staff members are also trained, end quote, Murray said. Quote, we use what we call ALERT training, Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training. It is a training that is provided by the state of Texas to all school districts across our state, end quote, Murray said. Quote, all of our staff members, as well as substitutes and administrators, are trained with ALERT training. We know, again, what to do in case of an emergency on campus, so our students, as well as staff members, receive regular ongoing training to equip them with what to do in case we have an emergency, end quote, he added. Quote, we also provide a see something, say something opportunity. Many times, the best prevention for any kind of emergency situation is the students and staff members themselves. So we provide anonymous opportunities for students and or staff members to report any kind of information that will lead our police officers and or school administrators to investigate potential dangerous situations, end quote, Murray said. Quote, we will continue to make sure that every single school in our system, as well as the district as a whole, remain safe for our students each and every day, as well as maintain the safety of each of our staff members, end quote, Murray said. Quote, if any parent has questions about school safety, I encourage them to reach out to their school. School administration can provide a bit more detail about what safety and security looks like on every campus within ECISD, end quote, he added. Registration for the 2022-2023 school year is now open, and families are encouraged to take part whether they are new or returning. Quote, we encourage everyone first to try the online experience. For those that are returning to ECISD, that registration online is incredibly simple. We have removed some of the prior requirements and made that a very simple process for you as parents, end quote, Murray said. Parents can also visit any school in ECISD. Quote, we have 44 schools, so any one of those schools can take care of your registration process. Even if you're not attending that school, they can still handle registration for you. So either visit online at www.ectorcountyisd.org or your local school to learn more about the registration process, end quote, Murray said. Quote, we encourage all of our families to do this as soon as possible. Knowing that your children are returning to school or attending us for the first time allows us to more effectively prepare for the first day of school, which is quickly approaching, end quote, he added. Murray was asked if the registration forms included a question on whether parents were immigrants, Texas driver's license, and make and model of their car. Murray said not all of those items are required. Quote, we have to have information that tells us where a student lives. There are residency pieces. So in ECISD, each of our schools has an attendance boundary. The place of residence helps us know and understand what school a child is assigned to. So we sometimes use a utility bill to help us know that. A driver's license, again, comes with that information. There are a variety of ways and documents that parents can use to show us their proof of residence, end quote, Murray said. Murray was also told about businesses that said they have students working for them that don't know how to count money or sign documents at the end of a grocery store shift, for example. Murray said he had not heard that and could not respond to those specific situations. Quote, when a student graduates from high school, they receive a high school diploma. That diploma certifies not only to that student and that family, that child has attained certain knowledge and skills to empower them to be successful in life, end quote, Murray said. Quote, that's our responsibility as a school system, is to make sure that all our students, when they leave us, are well prepared to be successful in the world of work, end quote, he added. He said cursive hasn't gone away, and that it's important that students know how to sign with pencil and paper, as well as electronically. Murray added that cursive is still taught in some schools, but is no longer a requirement. Quote, it's really communication that is taught today, and written communication happens in a variety of ways. Certainly print is a form, and there is cursive writing that is taught, but it is no longer a requirement, end quote, he said. Asked about STAR results trailing the state, Murray said if you look at the STAR and of course, results, you'll see significant growth, quote, in fact, outpacing the growth of the state in many areas, end quote. Quote, so we're incredibly excited about that, end quote, Murray said. He recommended students, teachers, and administrators for a quote, pretty incredible year, especially in the middle of a pandemic for all of the growth that occurred, end quote. Quote, we see that really not only STAR and of course exams, but even some of the assessments that we do in pre-K, kindergarten, first and second grade saw some pretty significant results there too, end quote, Murray said. He said if you look at where ECISD was 3 years ago, they were in a pretty low place. Quote, the system has trailed the state for many, many years, and we are closing those gaps. That is our opportunity to close the gaps in mathematics, in reading, and science and social studies at every level. Elementary, middle, and high school, when you look at the progress that we are making, that is what we are doing. We are narrowing the gap that existed, end quote, between ECISD and the state, Murray said. He acknowledged that, quote, we still have a lot of work to do, but those gaps are closing and we're pretty proud of the work that's happening, end quote. Asked about veteran educators who have left the district, Murray said schools generally transition during the summer. People make life choices like retirement or finding another opportunity. Quote, that's a normal part of school district transition, and really in the business world too, because there are always transitions, end quote, Murray said. He said he was not aware of any demotions. Arts Council of Midland hosting Celebration of the Arts fundraiser. Midland. The Arts Council of Midland is hosting its largest fundraising event of the year this weekend with its annual Celebration of the Arts Festival. The fundraiser, which is now in its 38th year, will feature over 60 artist booths with interactive art crafts, performances by local groups and organizations, as well as art-related lectures. The event will begin with its premiere party at 7 p.m. Friday at the Chaparral Center, and then from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday to the public, and noon to 5 p.m. Sunday. In the past, the event has taken place at the Bush Convention Center in downtown Midland. However, with work being done at the Convention Center, this year's event was moved to the Al G. Langford Chaparral Center at Midland College. Quote, we're utilizing the Chaparral Center in lieu of the Convention Center, end quote, Arts Council of Midland Executive Director Danny Haleva said. Quote, it's going to be great. We have lots of nonprofit organizations that will be there, and they'll be presenting themselves. I'm sure they'll have handouts and literature and such, end quote. The event has served as the cornerstone fine art, fine craft event in the Permian Basin. Over 7,000 attended last year's event. While this year's event will be at the Chaparral Center, it still has the distinction of being the longest-running event in downtown Midland. Quote, it means a lot to us because not only do we have people who have participated and volunteered in the past, but now their kids are doing it, so it's really an ongoing circle there, end quote, Haleva said. Quote, but it's important to the Arts Council of Midland because it's not only the activities that we present, but it's also our fundraiser. It's our largest fundraiser of the year, so it gives us an opportunity to do stuff throughout the year with the operating support, end quote. Haleva says that next year's Celebration of the Arts will be back at the Convention Center. Quote, we had over 6,000 people attend last year, and I thought we were home forever, end quote, Haleva said. Quote, we plan to go back to downtown next year. It's just the circumstances of their building flooding, end quote. Local entertainers, non-profit organizations, family activities, and special events will be featured throughout the weekend. Quote, on Saturday and Sunday, we have a large area that we call our arts activities area, end quote, Haleva said. Quote, there'll be something for about everyone. It'll be geared towards kids, but anyone is welcome, and we'll hopefully take advantage of that. We'll have a lot of different stations where people can do some takeaway projects, end quote. The event will also feature a ceramist named Jesse Trejo, who will be doing demonstrations of wheel throwing throughout the weekend. Quote, he's taught classes for us at the Council of the Arts and has agreed to do this for us, so we think it'll be exciting and different, end quote, Haleva said. The premiere party on Friday will be a sponsored, ticketed event. Quote, we'll have entertainment and a lot of the same things going on, end quote, Haleva said. Quote, it gives people a crack at the artists and their work and talking to them. There's a silent auction of items by each of the participating artists. There'll be music and food, so it'll be a good event for people to come and enjoy, end quote. How much the Arts Council of Midland raises from the event has varied in the last couple of years due to COVID, but Haleva is confident they can reach their goal of $100,000. The event didn't take place in 2020 because of the pandemic. Quote, on an average year, it's a little hard to say with the last few years with COVID and everything, but we're hoping that we'll exceed $100,000 this year, and that goes a long way towards our administrative operating expenses. It's important for sure, end quote. Obituary. Benjamin Benji Benny Fuentes, San Antonio. Benjamin Fuentes, 64, lost his battle to cancer on June 23, 2022, at his home in San Antonio, Texas. He was born on August 23, 1957, in Salinas, California. Herminio and Rodriguez Fuentes. Ben is preceded in death by his father, Herminio Fuentes, mother, Rodriguez Martinez Fuentes, brother, Mario Fuentes, and granddaughter, Lauren Ashley Keel. Ben is survived by his wife, Alicia Fuentes of San Antonio, Texas, son, Jimmy Ben Herrera, and wife, Robin of Hartsville, South Carolina, daughter, Tammy Allen, and husband, Danny of Midland, Texas, Juanito Rodriguez and family of Odessa, Texas, Herman Fuentes and family of Odessa, Texas, Delia Dominguez and family of Snyder, Texas, Georgia Ontiveros and family of Odessa, Texas, 13 grandchildren, 5 great-grandchildren, and many loving cousins, in-laws, and his medical center hospital family. A rosary will be held at 9 a.m. Friday, July 15, 2022, followed by a mass at 10 a.m. at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. Reception following church services at Holiday Inn, 5275 East 42nd Street, Odessa, Texas. Death Notices. Natalie Cherie Pettit, Odessa. Natalie Cherie Pettit, 40, of Odessa, died Friday, July 8, 2022 in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. July 15, 2022, First Baptist Church in Odessa. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Reverend Dr. Byron McWilliams is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Pamela Jane Pam Champion Price, Odessa. Pamela Jane Pam Champion Price, 77, of Odessa, died Sunday, May 22, 2022, in Odessa. Celebration of life will be held at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday, July 19, 2022, at Nancy Fife Cardozier Gallery, located in the Charles A. Sorber Visual Arts Studio on the UTPB campus. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Diego M. Valenzuela, Odessa. Diego M. Valenzuela, 34, of Odessa, died Sunday, July 10th, 2022, in Odessa. Funeral chapel service will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, July 15th, 2022, at Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory. Burial will follow at American Heritage Cemetery. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Marcia M. Ward, Odessa. Marcia M. Ward, 77, of Odessa, died Monday, July 11th, 2022, in Odessa. Graveside service will be held at 9:30 a.m., July 16th, 2022, at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.